Robert. It's great to have you back on the show. Second Timers Club. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a joy to be back.
Well, another great book from you. Would expect nothing less. And you write in this book that no British monarch, speaking of course of King Charles, has had a tougher act to follow, and that Queen Elizabeth taught a masterclass in how to reign, which, you know, from my lowly perspective, I would completely agree with that. So you literally wrote the book on King Charles. What is your assessment of his first 16 months on the throne?
Well, it certainly, we're in a place that I didn't expect us to be, as you say, Rachel. I mean, it was an incredible act to follow. No one had reigned as long as Elizabeth II. By the end of her reign, the end of her life, she was this almost mythical figure on the world stage. She'd just been around so long. She'd actually been reigning longer than half the countries on Earth have existed in their wow. present form. So, I mean, you know, that was the level of the challenge for King Charles. And I think, you know, most people thought he was going to do his best. But boy, were there some challenges ahead of him, not least, you know, on the private side with Harry, with Andrew, but also on the political constitutional side with the sort of rise of anti-monarchist feeling in some of his realms and the rise of sort of historical justice campaigns. So all in all, I think a lot of us expected him to have quite a rocky ride. And there certainly were some challenging moments, but here we are at the start of 24, and he's in a very strong place. He has the overwhelming support of the British public. Yes, there have been family issues. There are sort of ongoing. If you're a monarch, there's always something to worry about every day of the week. But you know, he's in a strong place. And crucially, and I hope I convey this in the book, he's really enjoying himself. He is enjoying being king, in the same way that his mother enjoyed being queen, even in the darkest days. And it was still something that she genuinely relished. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing quite a contented King Charles right now.
Well, King Charles had many, many years to prepare for this role. I mean, he had really a 74-year apprenticeship. And from your perspective, do you think that's paid off? And after waiting your whole life to take the throne, are you ever really prepared for that moment?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, and I always think it's worth remembering that Charles was born for this moment, for this position, whereas his mother wasn't, and his grandfather wasn't, mm-hmm. and his great-grandfather indeed wasn't. You know, George V was the youngest son, George VI was the youngest son, Elizabeth II was the daughter of a younger son. So, the throne sort of ended up coming to them by circuitous routes, if you like. Whereas with Charles, I mean, it was, you know, from the day he was born, it was quite clear one day he'd be monarch. And yeah, I mean, 74 years or 73 years, actually, it was he was 73 at the age of, at the time of his accession, 74 when he was crowned. And he clearly had given it, I think, much more thought than we had realized. He was very correct, I think, all through, particularly the latter years of the Queen's reign, not to, let us have sort of briefings or nods or little leaks here and there on what he was planning to do. He kept it very, very much to himself, to the point that most of his family didn't really know what sort of things he had in mind. His staff only had the sort of vague outline. I mean, things like, you know, obviously there were quite in-depth, detailed planning of what would happen when the Queen died. But in terms of how he would structure his reign, where he would actually physically be, where he would live, how he would approach all these questions we had. You know, what's he going to do with charities like the Prince's Trust? I think a lot of people expected him to be continuing to get very involved in environmental matters. And these were all questions that were up in the air without any sort of clear answer. As I say, because he felt that it was just inappropriate to talk about these things while the Queen was alive. And I do think it's remarkable when I look back now at at the sort of the last couple of years of the Queen's life. She was getting increasingly fragile. She was having what were described as mobility issues, often not turning up at events. Of course, she was widowed with the death of Prince Philip. And you would have expected, I think, in retrospect, to have heard more noises, if you like, coming from the media, the commentariat, political figures or whatever, people saying it really is time for the Queen to step aside, you know, it's time to move on. And just this month, we've seen the Queen of Denmark, Queen Margrethe of Denmark, doing just that. And I am surprised looking back that there weren't those voices. And there genuinely weren't. Nobody was saying, look, Elizabeth II is nearly 100. She's clearly not very well. It's time to change things around. That was not an argument that was taking place. And I think credit for that goes obviously to her for soldiering on. But it also goes to Charles for not letting that question be asked, if you like. Her authority was absolutely undiminished the day she died.
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that sets this book apart, there's a lot of things that sets this book apart. It's a great book, but the access that you had, and you mentioned that the king himself was involved in the book. He gave you access to materials to help you write it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, he didn't. I mean, he hasn't read it. His officials have had no say in it or editing it. What I was granted was by him specifically was access to the Royal Archives, which are in Windsor Castle in the heart of the Round Tower. And that was to look at material relating to the previous coronation. I wasn't given access to contemporary private material, private documents. I mean, those won't surface in public until after the king's died, and his papers are handed over to an official biographer many years hence. So I had from him, I had access to some of the files on the last coronation. Crucially, I was able to talk to lots of people in and around his circle, family, friends. Two prime ministers, you know, archbishops, people who were on the inside throughout this extraordinary period, and they very kindly agreed to talk. Almost all of them didn't want to speak publicly, but I think there was a sense that it's important to get the record straight, to have it, you know, have a clear record of what actually went on during what was, let's face it, probably the most seismic upheaval in modern post-war British history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in a little while, I'm going to ask you about the Queen. But before I do that, I have to ask, can you describe King Charles for us both as a monarch and as a man?
Well, yeah, I'll try and distill what I've done in the
you
book.
You wrote a huge book on it. So listeners, if you want to learn the whole thing.
I think I'm in a position to say a few words. Yeah, he's a very thoughtful man. He is, if you wanted to sort of set him apart from his mother in terms of their sort of approach to the job, their style, I think it would be fair to say that she was much more of a pragmatist, whereas he has always been a little bit more of a romantic. He's more thoughtful. He reads and reads. He reads loads of books. He stays up late reading and writing letters. And he's forever kind of convening meetings with experts on this and that. He has a very kind of quizzical, investigative mind. I think he would have made a good journalist, actually. Mm. And in that regard, I think he takes a lot after his father, who was always asking questions about everything to everybody. Whereas the Queen was a sort of quieter, more I think less inquisitive, more stoical, if you like. But since he's become king, what I think we've seen, and I've mentioned this earlier, you know, he's as a, almost a sort of relief that, you know, finally he's in charge. He can make his own decisions. He doesn't have to constantly think, oh, I wonder how this is going to play down with the Queen's officials, or, you know, I'd better get this cleared with the Prime Minister. He's enjoying being in charge. He's also, I think, he's a characteristic he shares with his mother, is that, she was and he is very more forgiving, really. I mean, I think, you know, you look at the way that the Duke of York has been, despite endless embarrassments in his various legal actions, Prince Andrew is, you know, he's still there at family events. He's included as part of the family unit, which I think a lot of people thought he might not be. And there we saw him at Christmas, not just at the heart of the family, but with his ex-wife, who was sort of welcomed back into the fold. She'd been sort of frozen out of the royal orbit for, you know, a good 20, 30 years. And it's the same with Harry and Meghan. I mean, yes, of course, there are plenty of issues that we all know well, but ultimately he's, you know, as I was told repeatedly by people around him, you know, he wants to keep the door open. He's not judgmental. He would, you know, dearly love to have a sort of improved relationship with his younger son. So he's quite open to change. He's got a lot of things he needs to change. I think his coronation, when you compare it, I mean, obviously it looked like a very traditional event with lots of, you know, crowns and ancient jewels and all the rest, but actually it was the most radical coronation we've ever seen in this country by a very long way. In terms of its diversity, inclusivity, the way that the wording was sort of carefully tweaked to bring it into the 21st century. So he's a modernizer, but he's also he's very traditional when it comes to things like, you know, architecture and landscape and the countryside and things like that. And I think he's less irritable than he used to be. It was often said, and there were numerous examples, that he did have a temper on him, and he could get quite cross about small things in the past. And right at the start of his reign, you may remember there were these sort of moments with a leaky pen.
Yeah, of course.
And everyone's going, "Oh, look at his! Oh, look, there he's boiling over." If he can get cross about a pen, just think what's going to happen when he's, you know, a few years into the reign. But actually, I mean, there hasn't really been that much more than the pen episode. You know, he's definitely comfortable in his own skin, and I think a lot of the credit for that, I have to say, goes to Queen Camilla as well, who's very much a sort of kind of calming and upbeat figure around the court, who I think has played a really important role.
Well, we are going to talk about the Queen in just a moment, but you write in the book, when asked what he would do if he could take a few days off being royal, the King has said he would like to immerse himself in art. In many ways, it would be lovely to have a sabbatical and find out a bit more about the origins of the royal collection. He told me some years ago, of course, talking about King Charles, speaking to you, Robert, and do a bit more studying in Italy because it is always rather fun. So imagining him, he's such a workhorse. His work ethic is unparalleled, but imagining him taking a few days off is strange. He's a bit of a workaholic. And do you think that work ethic, which is great, but he works sometimes until 4 a.m. Do you think he'll burn out eventually, or is he used to this type of pace? I mean, he doesn't even take a lunch. He doesn't eat lunch. So do you think he'll ever burn out?
Well, I'm sure his advisors constantly are urging him to take things a bit, you know, take more easily, because, I mean, yeah, he's under obviously a lot of stress. He's a head of state. He's a head of state of 14 other countries, as well as the UK, and he's now in his late 70s, in that he's 75. You know, he'll be 76 in November. And as you say, he doesn't eat lunch. He's always sort of pushing himself. He's very fit. He has. For a number of years, really since he was a young man, he's done these things called Canadian Air Force exercises. It's a sort of exercise regime invented during the war for Canadian pilots, and Prince Philip was a big fan of it, and so is Prince Charles. And it's just a sort of 10 to 15 minute daily exercise routine, but it's clearly it seems to work. He loves walking. He's a very agile 75-year-old, and as you say, I mean, he does stay up late at night. He likes to be on top of, you know, all the paperwork. I think one of the problems that we had in the run up to the coronation, things were certainly, there was a logjam of decisions. I remember it was getting quite stressful for some people with about a fortnight to go before the coronation, because people didn't know what they were supposed to be doing or wearing or what, you know, where, who, what role they were going to have, simply because everything was going across his desk, and he wanted to be on top of it. So people didn't dare make decisions without checking with him. So he's quite a, I mean, you know, some might say control freak, others might say he's a details man, but he, you know, he certainly, as I say in the books, it was said to me by a couple of people, you know, working too hard is not a problem for him. Having too much on his plate is not a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, he will cope. But he, yeah, I think he as he gets older, I think, you know, he would be wise to start delegating a bit more, because, you know, when you're in your late 70s, you can't, and he's, I mean, he hasn't even begun really to start touring the world, which mm-hmm. which, you know, there are a lot of invitations sitting there from other world leaders who very much want to have a state visit by the King of the UK. Not least, I'm sure he's you know, high on the list will be a trip to the US.
Yeah.
That's got to happen. he's in pretty strong. He's in good health. And I think as well as the other key thing, as well as Queen Camilla, is he does love being in Scotland, and particularly at Burke Hall, the house on the Balmoral Estate. And I've noticed that he's spending more and more time there. I think that's where he goes to recharge the batteries. So as long as we've got Queen Camilla and Burke Hall, I think he'll be fine.
Well, speaking of Queen Camilla, I said we would talk about her for a second. You write that she is a great asset to the king. So what makes her the right partner for him in this role?
Well, I think she has that very important balance of being an equal, of being someone he can confide in about everything, but at the same time of sort of accepting, respecting his position. Not in a sense of, you know, I mean, she does call him the boss, mm-hmm. But everybody knows that kind of she's the boss, really. and it's quite fun watching them on walkabouts or engagements together. And he does, he's always been one for sort of getting into conversations, and you see everybody looking at their watches, and everyone's a bit nervous about going up to him and saying, "Look, sir, frankly, could you just, you know, get a move on because we're late." The only person who can do that is Queen Camilla, and she does. And I've seen her. She has this rather funny habit of she's got sort of sharp corner of her handbag, and she'll just stick it in the small of his back, and he'll suddenly turn around, and it's like, "Oh right, better go," you know. And that's her. And other things. I mean, I see that they, you know, he's always opening windows. He loves fresh air. And she quite likes warm, cozy rooms. So those two don't really go together. So there's often quite a battle over windows. You know, he'll come into a room and ask for all the windows to be open, and then she'll come in and have them all closed again. So there are a few window battles. But you know, it's quite interesting. I mean, the Queen was famous for her corgis, and Prince Charles always liked having dogs. But the dogs around the house, they are Queen Camilla's dogs. They're not his dogs. There are two Jack Russells. The corgis have gone. The age of the corgi is over. We are in Jack Russell territory now, and they're Queen Camilla's Jack Russells, and he loves them dearly, but they're hers. You know, and he doesn't make. I mean, he has very clear views on things like architecture and design, and how the sort of the administration of all the palaces and the estates and what's going to happen to them. I mean, that's very much his call. She wouldn't get involved in that. But she'll certainly be the one who is sort of talking, has ideas about how to approach a big event, whether it's a state visit or whatever. She does a lot of that, on the entertaining side of things. She's very central to that. Whereas, you know, the late Queen would do all that on her own.
Mm-hmm.
As monarch, Prince Philip didn't really get involved. The king, I think, relies on her a lot for those sort of things.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, the book is filled with so many interesting anecdotes, just as some that you just shared. What was the most interesting piece of research that you gleaned while writing the book?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think hearing and discovering the real stories of what was going on in those hours and days around the death of the Queen. I mean, that was extraordinary, hearing how it really did take people by surprise, because clearly, you know, the Queen had started, her health was declining all through 22, and towards the end of the summer, things were getting worse, but you know, she was very sort of stoical about it, and what she was absolutely determined, she would, you know, her number one job is to appoint the prime minister. That's the fundamental role of a constitutional monarch, and she was determined to do that, and she did that. But having done that on September the 6th, she appointed Liz Truss as the last prime minister of her reign. The speed with which she then went downhill, I think, took everybody by surprise. And hearing the how all that unfolded, how you know, the doctors, family, staff, everyone was thinking that this was going to be a matter of days, and suddenly it turned into a matter of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredibly, I think, fortunate that the king was that Charles was there. I mean, he wasn't at her bedside at the moment she died. One of the most extraordinary things is to learn that he was actually at the wheel of a car when it happened. You know, we were all raised on that story of Princess Elizabeth in 1952 going up the giant fig tree in the Aberdare National Park as a princess, and coming down the next morning as a queen. You know, these moments matter. They become part of history, and I think learning about how you know, all the decisions that were being taken really very very quickly in those hours after the death of the Queen, despite, you know, yes, there were lots of plans in place, and yes, she was, you know, well into her 10th decade, but at the same time, you know, a lot had to be decided, and a lot could have gone wrong, and it didn't. And again, I mean, I think finding out about a lot of the thinking behind the coronation, a lot of the decisions that the king took early on about how to, you know, where what are we going to do with all these palaces? Because you know he's got more residences, I think, than any monarch ever. Right? He's got 11 if you add them all up. And I think people, I expected that to become a quite a controversial issue quite early on, but it hasn't actually. People haven't made a big thing of it because I think there is a genuine understanding that it's that situation is not sustainable. And that there are going to be have to be quite big decisions about a lot of the royal residences. They just, you know, they haven't happened yet, but they will happen. But yeah, finding out all those, as I said, that's on the cover of the book, the inside story. I think it's just hearing it from those who were there. It's has been utterly fascinating.
Well, Prince William is now next in line to the throne. I want to talk about him and King Charles for a second. Can you share a little bit about what their relationship is like, not just as, you know, father and son, but also as their relationship as monarch and heir?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. It's a very good question because I mean history is littered with stories of the tensions between the monarch and the heir, and there were fairly well documented tensions between not so much between the late Queen and Prince Charles, but certainly between the late Queen's staff and Prince Charles. I mean they would have quite a lot of there was quite a lot of tension at times, particularly when he was doing some of his more radical charity initiatives like his Prince's Trust, which at times were, you know, bringing him pretty, not in exactly into opposition to, but certainly rubbing up against government policy in the years of Margaret Thatcher. So you know that was that at times was quite a feature of Charles the heir to the throne. William is a less confrontational figure, I think it's safe to say. He doesn't, whereas Prince Charles had sort of big world views on you know whether it's the environment, education, the way that we build our cities and towns, the sort of interaction between man and nature. And I think Prince William is more, it's more practical actually, rather like his grandmother, the Queen, who, you know, didn't lie awake at night wondering about the meaning of life and what does it all mean and reading, lots of dense books on the subject. You know, he like the Queen, I think William is a sort of likes to have, you know, sensible briefings, get to the heart of the matter, make quick decisions. And isn't you know he's not looking for looking for quarrels with his father. I think they disagree. I mean they do disagree on some things. As I mentioned in the book, I mean Prince Charles is almost evangelical about organic food and organic farming, whereas Prince William is a bit more pragmatic. It's sort of, well, organic farming's fine. It's nice if you can do it, but actually, it's quite expensive. Not everybody could do it. So, you know, there are. Let's not get too obsessive about it. I mean, that's a sort of possibly the difference between the two of them. I think you could say that King Charles has a sort of he's more of a purist on these matters, and he's more intellectual, I think that'd be fair to say. I mean, I talked to people around them about their tastes, you know, what I mean, Prince Charles loves his books and his classical music and his opera. And Prince William loves, as someone said, he loves action movies, Batman and Deadpool. And he's quite keen on AC/DC, but he's not mad keen on Wagner. So I think they're just, you know, there's a sort of generational difference. But I think there's also a very acute and you know profound sense that that you know this is a team operation. There's no point in one side looking wonderful and brilliant or exciting or glamorous at the expense of the other. And I think it has been quite interesting how you know I mean at the moment you know William and Kate are they are the younger royal generation. I mean now that Harry and Meghan have disappeared, they are the future. They're the young ones. All the other working members of the family are now of retirement age. And so William and Kate could be very, you know, they could be very glamorous. I mean, they could be, you know, the sort of, you know, the most glamorous sort of red carpet couple on the planet if they wanted to. But I think they accept that if they did that, that would, you know, that would upstage the monarch. And that's not what you do. So I think there's a real understanding. And I you know, over Christmas I wrote a documentary which came out in Britain. I don't think it's come out in the US yet, but it was looking behind the scenes at a lot of the coronation preparations. And there were some very touching scenes there, and I reflect that in the book and more, because you know, I was watching all the build-up to the coronation, and just watching the way that the you know, the Prince of Wales and Kate and their children, you know, they really were part of the build-up and the whole coronation day, and it was a bit like watching a kind of family wedding unfold. I mean, there was a real sense of a family pulling together. I mean, to get back to your question, of course the father and son will have their differences. Some will be on the substance of particular things. A lot will be simply in the approach to things. Prince William will often turn up at events with no tie on. And that would be unthinkable to his father. I mean, I don't think, you know, he wouldn't see Prince Charles unless it was clearly he was, you know, on it was a sort of, if he was out doing the garden or something, you know, he would always have a tie. And you know, William is just of his generation.
Well, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book and how much we've enjoyed our time with you this morning. We could talk to you forever, but we will leave with one final question. And that is, I'm not sure there's many people other than his family and the man himself that know as much about King Charles as you do. So what is something a lot of people don't know about him that you wish they did?
Oh, golly. Well, like I said, I mean, I think his I mentioned earlier the fact that he refuses to eat lunch. He says, I'm like a camel. I go through the whole day without refueling. I think he's quite a risk taker. He's quite a speed machine. I've had talking to people who've been in a car with him. He drives very fast, but very well. I mean, he's a good driver, and he's a very fast skier. We haven't seen him on skis for a bit, and he didn't go skiing. Well, he hasn't been skiing since he was since he became king, not least because it would have been quite risky ahead of his coronation to be tearing down a ski slope. I think he has a sort of, maybe he's got a sort of fatalistic streak. He's on the occasions when he's been in positions of considerable danger, and let's face it, you know, he has faced down a guy running at him with a gun. Yeah. In Australia. You know, he does. I mean, he has done extraordinary things. He's probably been swimming under the Arctic ice cap in a deep sea diving suit when he was younger. He did parachute courses when he became colonel of the parachute regiment. He insisted on going through their full parachute training, which he didn't need to do, but he did. So I think there's a sort of constant inner sense of. He's a bit of a risk taker. He likes to. I think there's a need to sort of, you know, keep proving himself. And another thing actually, which I have noticed new since he became king, but just keep looking at what ties he wears. I mentioned earlier that Prince William isn't very keen on wearing ties. Charles has got a big tie collection, but he suddenly started wearing these kind of coded ties. That have sort of messages that we're always trying to decipher. and clearly the one he likes most, it has a little dinosaur pattern on it. And I got up close and the dinosaur, it's a T-Rex. And I said, one of his staff, is this a kind of T-Rex joke going on here? And they said, oh, I couldn't possibly comment. To which I take that to mean yes. And another occasion, he was, and I describe it in the book. He was meeting a lot of very eminent people from all the oldest universities in Britain, And I got up to it, and his tie, I noticed it had an owl pattern. It's covered in owls, and I think there was a sort of wise owl vibe coming out of his neckwear. His wardrobe, and normally elderly chaps in suits aren't terribly interesting, but this one is. So keep an eye out.
Well, I've learned a lot about King Charles today, and I'm definitely going to be zooming in on photos of his ties here on out. So, as Rachel mentioned at the start of this episode, this book, as with all of your books, is really fantastic. So, to our listeners, go check out Making of a King, King Charles III and the Modern Monarchy. It is out as of January 18th, so it's available now. And thank you so much again, Robert, for being here with us today.
Thank you both very much. It's a great pleasure to be back with you both.